Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour of the program, Samantha Bee, the most senior correspondent for The Daily Show. She has a new book about her life. Oh my gosh, what a life. The long, magnificent tradition of divorce in her family, and it is a long tradition. Going to school, her love of Jesus, who was totally her boyfriend when she was from the ages of 3 until 12, I believe. Some of her boyfriends, her grandmother, old people, her hands. It's a very, very funny read because she's a very funny woman. She is, as I said, on the cast of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, has been there since 2003. And she says she has systematically eliminated all those before her. She was born and raised in Toronto. When she's not working, she enjoys walking her toddlers in circles around her tiny apartment and correcting spelling errors on menus. Her husband is fellow Daily Show correspondent Jason Jones. And I read about a month ago an interview with her, and this was on June 7th. It said that she was 8 months pregnant, so I figured today she is 9 months pregnant, and I'm worried that we may have to interrupt this interview because she's going to have a baby. I hope that doesn't happen, but who knows? It might. Samantha, hello.
Hello.
Aren't you due today to have a baby?
Please, can I tell you that I wish I was due today? Oh, you could just coach me through it. I'm sure you would do a good job. I believe in you. I'm sure it's happened on the show many times. I am 9 months pregnant.
Right.
That really, I mean, many people don't know that you really are pregnant until the 10-month mark. You're pregnant to the end of the 9th month.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You know, so I've still got really, you would not know it from looking at me, but I actually still have 3 to 4 weeks left to go.
Why?
People are amazed.
Because you're not heavy or because you are heavy?
Because I look huge, because I am just like, I'm like a zoo animal that's been left out and is running down the street in New York City. People don't know what to do with me. It's very terrifying.
Well, maybe it's two babies.
Oh, God.
Wouldn't that be something?
We know it is confirmed. Modern technology has confirmed for us.
Oh, okay.
Single baby.
You say at the beginning of your book, you have your children, and you certainly hope they will never write a book about you.
God, no. Never.
Never.
My parents figure so prominently in this book, and with their blessing, of course, and they're quite thrilled with it, which would surprise a lot of people. Anyway, they are. And it reminded me, when I was a kid, my mother bought a copy. She bought, you know, the hardcover copy of Mommy Dearest when it first came out, and she read it. And I then immediately read it. I think maybe I was 8 years old or something like that. And, you know, the whole time I was reading it, my mother was looking at me, and she would say to me, please don't write a book about me. Do not write a book about me. I know what you're thinking. I know you're thinking that you want to. And I was like, no, I would never do that. And here we are.
Right. You know. How could you not, though? Because I don't know too many people, Samantha, who have grown up under the circumstances that you grew up. I mean, your family, they were very open, but how many parents watch pornography with their very young child?
With their children?
I know.
Not too many. I don't say that I mean, I survived it. I'm fine, I think, but I don't recommend it. I'm not planning to do the same with my children.
However,
I did end up on the other side of that with a pretty open mind, so that's a good thing.
Right.
The results were not terrible. They were not dire.
Yeah. So tell me about this long, magnificent tradition of divorce in your family. It's everybody was divorced.
Everybody.
Everybody.
I mean, really, everybody. My marriage to Jason has the greatest chance of, I guess actually that's not true, because there were some 20 to 30 year marriages that still ended in divorce. You know, just when you think, fine, we've been together for 30 years, we can stick it out, we can make it to the end, let's be companions. People in my family don't go for that. They untether themselves with great regularity. There has not been a successful marriage in my family since before the turn of the century.
Like, wow.
People in my family were getting divorced in, you know, 1908.
Right.
When it was
very unusual
to acquire. I mean, it was very difficult process back then. You had to prove some very terrible things, which were probably all true.
So did you and Jason then enter your marriage with a bit of trepidation?
I think Jason did. He's fine. He comes from a long line of straight shooters and happy marriages, so he, you know, he's okay. He's covered. But I definitely think there was a moment in his life when he kind of looked at my family history, and I think his family did too.
I'll bet
they kind of looked at my family and went, "Really? Okay, all right. Let's everybody cross your fingers, take a deep breath, you can do this thing."
You say that you love working with him. You're in the same office, aren't you?
We do. We share an office. We have parallel desks. It's very dorky. We are really dorky people. We spend a lot. I'm not saying that we don't spend any time away from each other, but we do spend a great deal of time together. And I am speaking for him when I say that he loves it. When we do, it's actually, it works very well for us. And I think probably also because it's not going to last forever, so we're kind of enjoying it. It's very difficult when you have young children at home to connect, you know, on a kind of adult human level.
Right.
So it does give us the opportunity to kind of catch up and check in with each other.
When you say it's not going to last forever, we're talking the job, the marriage,
job.
The life, or what?
The life better last. Life goes on forever, I think. It never ends. But I certainly hope that the marriage lasts forever. But the job, we know, won't last forever. We've worked together many times in the past, so.
Didn't you meet each other on some kind of dorky show?
Oh, God. Oh, we met actually doing the fall fair circuit, doing a live action anime series. It was called Sailor Moon, and we were not the characters. We were not the voices of those. We did not voice the characters. There is no dignity in this job, but we did play the costume character version of them on stage at various cider fests. That's how we actually met. So, you know, a marriage born from those origins can't go wrong.
You're right.
You've seen each other at your very rock bottom. How much worse could it possibly get?
Right. Well, you've got to tell us some of your stepmother stories. And why don't we start with the camping trips, and particularly the bear story. It is just hysterical.
Oh, thank you. Well, she was very... I should preface this by saying that my father was kind of volleyed from home to home. My father had remarried my stepmother, who's a wonderful person, but she was very concerned about me because I did not appear to be a very normal child.
You weren't normal at all.
No, not normal. Very indoors-based, very much growing up in the shadow of my grandmother, whom I loved dearly, but, you know, I dressed like a little old lady. I behaved like a little old lady at the age of 7. I was just a tiny, just practicing. An Estelle Getty in training. I practically had a little purse, you know, that I would carry around. And she was concerned for me because I didn't want to go outside. I didn't have any of the desires that other children had to, you know, ride a bicycle or swim or any of those things. I just didn't care for it. It wasn't, really just truly didn't care for it.
Right.
And so she decided that we should go, that we needed to start camping and getting me outdoors, going to summer camp and doing the things that normal children did, playing with, you know, a ball, let's say. It was so foreign to me. I just had no idea what she was. I was a reader. I read. And so we started out with these kind of mini camping trips. I'm sure it's the same in Wisconsin. It's, you know,
yes, it is.
Wisconsin and Canada, there's a similarity there. I don't know about you, but we kind of rock and roll camp. Like you drive your Camaro to an abandoned parking lot and open the doors and blast Black Sabbath into the night sky and eat a hot dog.
Hey, that's life, right? That's living.
That's where we started. That was kind of the genesis of our camping trips, but then it really wasn't wholesome enough for Marilyn. Like, she had a lot of trouble dealing with the kind of, you know, the monkey business in the various rock and roll campgrounds. And so we made them more nature-based, and then we would travel to Algonquin Park and what have you and try and get some, like, real nature and hikes and, you know, beaver canoe trips and with beavers and things like that. And we encountered a bear at one point on one of our camping trips, which was really, truly amazing because Marilyn, you know, with Bear Bells, you know, Marilyn was so chatty and industrious, you know, that any bear that would kind of deal with her chatting and talking and singing along the trail was a very hungry, rabid bear. You know, most bears, they run from you when you make a lot of noise, and she just couldn't help herself from making a lot of noise, that kind of person. And it kind of confronted us, and she yelled at it. She literally shouted it into submission and saved all our lives on that camping trip. My father and I were very much prepared to die immediately. We just gave up instantly. We had no backbone whatsoever, but her backbone, thank goodness, kept us.
Thank goodness. Oh, you are
for her,
funny.
God bless her.
Right. Grandmother stories. You think you're going to read about this, you know, which she was, you know, loving, kind, involved grandmother. But you got to talk about her sense of fashion, because the stories are hilarious. And you got your sense of fashion as a young girl from your grandmother.
She damaged my sense of style. There's no question that I am only recently developing a style of my own. It's always been kind of, you know, granny panties and one-piece bathing suits,
right,
which I still favor. I mean, I can't help it. There's nothing I could do about it. I've never worn a two-piece in my life.
Really?
Never in my life. Huh. You know, it kind of all goes back to that, I think. She was just very, because she worked at the school that I attended, which was a Catholic school. She was the secretary there. And I was, you know, for quite a while, I was living with my mother, who was so bohemian. I mean, just, I don't even want to say bohemian. She just was very laissez-faire.
Mm-hmm.
So she would just let me wear whatever. She would just give me money, I mean, literally when I was 8 years old, and tell me to go clothes shopping. And so I would go to, like, the local discount store, which was called the Byway, and I would just buy terribly uncoordinated, bloody-looking outfits. Like, I just had no idea how to dress myself. I just didn't know what to do.
You were 8 years old.
Just a little kid.
Right.
It's basically the time when you really need guidance.
Exactly.
You need a little.
You don't need to be watching pornography films, right?
You don't need to be doing those things particularly. So I would choose my own outfits, and they were terrible. And then I would incorporate pieces from my mom's wardrobe into what I was wearing. And I just looked like, I mean, I really just looked like I came out of, you know, a slutty dumpster going to school. And a Catholic school, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't have uniforms, but there were standards.
Right.
So my grandmother, who was horrified by all of these choices, my sartorial choices, did not impress her. But she knew that I really had no choice in the matter and that I couldn't take care of myself in that way. But she had some conflict with my mother, so she couldn't totally interfere, except that she bought all my wardrobe. So I would get to school, and then she would change me into something that suited her and that suited the school and that was, you know, age-appropriate, really, for her. But she loved it. So it was all cowl neck sweaters, you know, soft pumps.
Except for that flat gym outfit. That gym outfit sounded wild.
My gym outfit was great. She knew that I needed a gym outfit because we didn't really have a regulation outfit for gym. So she bought me a one piece sweater tard, a cashmere sweater tard.
A cashmere.
With a patent leather belt. And puffy, it had puffy sleeves. It was really something that you would wear on the lanai on an episode of The Golden Girls.
You really have to wear it on the show sometime.
Can I tell you how much I wish I still had that?
Oh, I'll bet. But you can have one made.
I would put my child in it and take pictures.
Oh.
If she could have sent me to gym class in slingbacks, she would have. She really would have. Running shoes were not her forte. Coming for running shoes with my grandmother was just hilarious endeavor. Gave up.
Who used to dye your hair when you were three? Was it your grandmother? She thought you ought to be.
She dyed my mother's hair.
Your mother's hair. That's right.
She dyed my mother's hair when my mother was born. And believe me, all of the women in my family have dark hair. We are all dark-haired women. I dye my hair. I get highlights in my hair.
Right.
But by nature, we are all chestnut brown to almost black and bone straight hair.
Uh-huh.
Bone straight. But when my mother was born, my grandmother was in a Shirley Temple phase. And so she felt, I mean, she was literally offended by the fact that she hadn't given birth to a curly-haired blonde cherub. She just couldn't understand it. There was no curly hair anywhere in my family. No blondes whatsoever. Nobody with blue eyes. We all have brown eyes. And so she would cut my mother's hair. She would have my mother's hair cut and dyed into a tiny and permed. Into a Shirley Temple. And she was 3 years old. I mean, she was a little kid. There are so many pictures of my mother with a little Shirley Temple, with a bow in her hair, and a little Shirley Temple dress. And when they finally gave up, she finally gave up on it at one point and got her something called the Italian boy, which my mother will never forgive her for. She cannot forgive.
Italian boy. Some of us have family stories, and some of us really have family stories. Samantha Bee is our guest this hour. Her book is I Know I Am, But What Are You? If you'd like to join our conversation to talk with the most senior correspondent of The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, 800-486-8655 is the number, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that. It's talk@WPR.org. Rhonda put together some clips from The Daily Show as well, so we'll hear a few of those, and we'd love to hear from you. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Samantha Bee is our guest this hour. I Know I Am, But What Are You? Is the title of her brand new book. We have a few clips from The Daily Show that we thought we would play. I think this one might be one of your favorites, Samantha. Okay. It's, if you want to set it up for us, Right to Choose.
Oh, I really... Is that the piece from the convention?
Yes.
The Republican convention?
Yes.
Well, we went to the Republican convention with the idea to get people to just even say the word choice. Because they really did seem to have eradicated it. This is at the Republican convention, mind you.
Right.
They really did seem to have eradicated the word from their vocabulary. No one wanted to say it. No one actually even wanted to say the word. It became this very toxic word for them. I don't know who sent the memo out that did not allow anyone to say it. But we had a devil of a time. We spent maybe even two days there trying to get people to say it. It was a very interesting experience.
And here it is.
I'm sorry. What's the word I'm looking for? It's her family. It's her... Oh, God, what is the word? What is the word I'm looking for? It's like an alternative, or if you have two things. You be Sarah Palin, and I'll be her 17-year-old daughter.
Bristol, you know, you and I have always been able to openly discuss things.
What do you want to talk to me about? I'm too busy right now, Mom. Can you get out of my room? It's like when you have a lot of options and you have to select one. What's the word I'm looking for? What is the word?
Adoption is one.
No, there's a specific word I'm looking for.
I'm sure the family will be able to make the best decision for them.
But they'll have the freedom to make that decision. Hold on a second. I'm talking to my boyfriend. Can I call you back? My mom is in my room. She wants to talk to me about something. Hold on. I'll call you back.
Well, yes, I think that the family decision would become as how, yes, okay.
Oh my God, I totally heard you. Why are you bothering me? Oh my God, don't do this to me. It's, you know, when you have like an alternative, what's the word I'm looking for? Alternative.
A different choice?
Choice, yes, exactly. Every family, every person should have the choice to decide what's best for them.
Samantha Bee, and one of her favorite skits, it's very funny. You can go to YouTube, too, and see the visual. Obviously, that's what happened. Oh, you go to The Daily Show. Go to The Daily Show.
Oh, right.
That's the place to go.
TheDailyShow.com.
TheDailyShow.com is a place to go.
That was one of the more cathartic experiences I've had on the show.
Yeah, very funny. Let's go to some phone calls. We start with Paul from La Crosse. Hi, Paul.
Hi. I'm a regular visitor to Comedy Central, and one of the little pieces they have there now is something that shows all the women on the show sitting on the set, and it said, what's it like to work on The Daily Show when you have girl parts? So since I haven't seen the video, and, you know, comedy, especially television comedy, late-night comedy, is supposed to be male-dominated and very sexist. Mm-hmm. But what's it like to be a woman working on The Daily Show?
For me, it's been terrific. And for all of the women who, let me preface this by saying that there were some recent blog posts about our show and the possibility that John is a sexist who has sexist hiring policies, particularly because there's not been a great female presence in the correspondent department on the show. I've been there almost by myself for 7 years, although Kristen Schaal has been there, and now we have a new correspondent as well. So there's been a lot of criticism and a kind of an ongoing narrative about sexism at The Daily Show, and we just really got very tired of it. Everyone, there are, you know, almost 40% of the staff is female, and everyone became very tired of hearing that same old story when it is not our current experience at the show. I understand that there have been others in the past who have felt that way, but all of us were upset by it. The women at the show who are not on camera per se felt very marginalized. They felt like their contributions to the show were not recognized at all by people outside of the show. And so we wanted to write a letter to kind of respond to those charges once and for all. I mean, people ask me all the time what it is like to be a woman at The Daily Show, and I have always answered the question in the same way, which is that it's honestly been terrific for me. I have never felt discriminated against based on my gender or anything like that. I've only ever felt supported in all of my feminine business, you know, whatever that means. And so I think, you know, it was a response of just fatigue and just, can we put this to bed, please?
Right. So
all of the women wanted to be photographed, and we composed a letter, which we felt was a reflection of how we felt about our jobs.
And you put on this,
that we felt very positive. We feel incredibly positive.
Yeah. You put on the side a partial list of things John has supported us through, including...
He has. He's a mensch. I mean, he's a great guy, and we enjoy working for him. We do not have the kinds of negative experiences that people wish that we had in some way so that they could write juicy stories. Unfortunately, the story is sort of boring. We all do our jobs, and we work very hard, and we just don't feel pressure based on our gender. Mm-hmm. We feel pressure because it's a successful late-night comedy show, and we work very hard to make it so. But, you know, there are an awful lot of women who contribute an awful lot to the show, and they are just so tired of the world acting as though they don't exist.
You know, one of the things I'm thankful for on that show, too, is John's looking at books and the ability to do uproarious comedy, but also to do some of the world's most pressing issues.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he draws attention to a lot of issues that we need to pay attention to.
He does. He's gifted in that regard. I mean, he really reads those. He really reads those books.
I believe that.
He really does. And because he's a super smart guy, an avid reader, and he's intellectually curious. You know, he has like a driving intellectual curiosity
mm-hmm.
that propels the show, that completely propels the show. I mean, he is truly the editorial voice of our show. You know, nothing gets on the air without going through John, which is not typical, as is my understanding of other shows. You know, he definitely delegates because he has to, you know, in some ways, but everything comes back to him ultimately. He's the last stop on the train. So, you know, it's very filtered through John's worldview, which is only a good thing.
Right. Isn't it something, as I was reading about your life in your book, isn't it something, what do you think about the fact that you had this incredibly wacky life? I mean, I just don't know anybody who's had this kind of life. And then you wind up on The Daily Show.
Well, you know, it's really, It's sad in some ways because I think a lot of people, like particularly young women, want to talk to me about my glorious rise to The Daily Show. You know what I mean? They want the story to be rich and filled with inspiration, but the story is not really
it's
inspiring.
Not. No.
You know, except in the sense that you can, you know, you can come from humble beginnings and make something of yourself.
Right.
You know, I ended up very late in life deciding what I wanted to do with my life. You know, not very late in life, but very late in life for a performer.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of unusual to not know that you want to be a performer until your late 20s. Most people kind of come to that decision when they're 8, and then they stick with that. You know, my husband is an example of someone who knew that he wanted to do it from the time he was 3. Just always wanted to be a performer, but not me. And so I just started doing comedy. Comedy kind of saved my skin, really, because once I decided I wanted to be a performer, I felt that I wanted to be a very serious, dramatic performer. And then, really, no one ever hired me. I was terrible. I think I'm not very good. I really was not hireable in any kind of serious capacity. And my friends encouraged me to get into comedy because I've always been comedic. But, you know, you're comedic in your life. You don't necessarily think it's going to translate into a career. It wasn't really in my wheelhouse. But I did start doing comedy. And the moment that I started doing comedy, my whole life
changed. That was it. Well, it's hard not to do comedy considering your upbringing, because every story is, you know, it's either terribly pathetic or tragic, or it is hilarious.
Well, I definitely try to see the comedy in every aspect of my life, and that has served me very well because, you know, there are definitely people who read the book and are trying to interpret it in a sad way. It seems like people have to make a special effort to think that I had a bad life, but I don't see it that way at all. I see it in a very positive way. I have the love of my family. Listen, they're all completely crazy, but we all love each other. And really, what more can you ask for? I guess things could have been a little more idyllic, for sure, definitely. But I don't think that I would be the person that I am today had there not been some compromising situations.
Right. Let's go to Jim and Galena next. Hi, Jim. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. And I'm going to buy the book. It's interesting listening to it. But the wife is an avid reader, and we both, I'm in my 70s, and we both watch the show every opportunity we get. It's an excellent show. And I tell you, some of the favorite sketches you put together with John on making fun of the other news outlets. You play a clip, but then he corrects it with his interpretation of what they've actually should have said. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
And some of the guests you have on, it's a very educational show. And I wished I know they're hard to put together. I know you work hard on it. But I tell you, keep up the good work. It's just a breath of fresh air
to see
an honest show, honest comedy show on the air like that.
Thank you so much. That is so appreciated. Please say hello to your wife.
It must be a hard show to put together. You can tell it's done with great care.
And with an incredible staff of people. You know, you have John's brain at the helm, which is essential, and then an incredible staff of people making those, you know, making his ideas come to fruition, an incredible research department and a studio department who just are constantly going through, you know, tape after tape after tape of or recording after recording of news shows and commentary shows and all of that stuff to make the show what it is.
Yes.
And at a furious pace. I mean, the show is daily.
Right,
week,
yeah.
So.
And television eats up time, right?
It does.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about being an old person and how you learned how successful you will be as an old person because of your hands.
I have very elderly-looking hands. I have always had them. They are very wrinkly and very... They have always been that way, though. Honestly, when I was a baby, when I was a kid, my hands were incredibly wrinkly and small and kind of old-looking. And I think that it's been good for me because I'm not afraid to... It has made me unafraid to grow old. I love old people. I honestly love old people so much. It's like I'm one of them. We just have a kind of a... we have an understanding between us that I get it. Like, I know where life is going, and I think that's a very valuable thing to know. Listen, I'm not trying to, you know, age myself before my time, but I feel in many ways more equipped to deal with old age than others my own age. Everyone's very afraid to get old, but I just see it as a natural. I mean, it is natural. There's nothing more natural about it. We're all terminal.
Right.
You know.
Yeah, I know.
We're all going to go there. So I turned 40 this year, or I turned 40 last October, and people in my life were genuinely upset for me. Yeah, you know, people would call me and they were like, "Are you okay? Are you?" I know, it's a really big step. How do you feel? I was like, what are you talking about?
So you decided.
What do you mean, how do I feel? I feel alive. I'm 40.
And I'm going to have a baby.
Yeah. And this is, you know, these things happen to 40-year-olds from time to time. And, you know, what's to lament about it? So, you know, I feel like having old people in my life with tremendous vitality has given me. has given me a kind of a fresh outlook on that. I don't fear it.
Yeah.
I don't fear it. I'm going to be good. I'm good.
You're
I already
good.
Wear the
good.
Panties.
Good.
I'm set.
I like this story about your grandmother. Who was the exercise guy? She was doing exercises every morning. Jack LaLanne.
Oh yeah, she used to just she did Jack LaLanne. I mean, you can still see him, I think, on maybe ESPN Classic or something. Have you ever seen one of his workouts? They're hilarious.
You know, I have. Where is he from? Is he from? I'm trying to think. Maybe he. Yeah, I grew up in Chicago, and he was popular in Chicago among my mother's friends, and she may have done a little Jack LaLanne too.
I mean, everybody's mother did a little Jack LaLanne. He would wear those pleated, you know, with the seam down the front. He would wear those pleated jodhpurs. Practically, they weren't quite jodhpurs, but they were stirrup slacks. And a nice tight shirt and a belt. And he just did kind of like twists.
He did twists.
Just effortless twists.
We should bring him back. Resurrect this show, right? Wouldn't that be fun?
I feel like he's still alive and very, very fit.
Right. He was very fit. Jack LaLanne.
They worked for him. And they worked for my grandmother. She used to stand in front of the television.
And do the twists.
In a skirt and a blouse. You know, when you exercise in a skirt and a blouse. And little footies. Like she had little isotoner slippers on, so she wouldn't slip on the problem. And she would just do minor twists and little, like, tiny leg lifts and things like that, and they kept her completely trim.
Right.
When I think about my grandmother's exercise or regimen, I don't know why anybody bothers. I mean, I keep getting on the treadmill and things like that. If you want to be super skinny, that's one thing, but all you really need is a juicer. And a Jack LaLanne.
And a Jack LaLanne tape.
The classic Jack LaLanne series. They keep tiny people very small.
Oh, there's a good skit for you, too, that you need to do that. We need
I know.
Yeah, that'd be good. Samantha Bee is our guest. She has a book now, I Know I Am, But What Are You? She is the most senior correspondent, having just turned 40, on the Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And she is very funny, and the stories in the book are quite hilarious. We welcome more phone calls if you'd like to join the conversation. 800-486-8655 is our number. And the email address, talk@wpr.org. We'll hear some more clips from the show, too, as we continue. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Election season again, and everyone seems to be asking the same question.
Do you think we're ready for a woman president?
Is America really ready for a woman president?
Is the nation ready for a woman president?
It's a puzzler. Women have taken great strides forward, becoming doctresses, bodybuilderesses, and firemen women. Women even make up 3/4 of the hosts of The View. I couldn't help but wonder, is America ready for a woman president? It was a typical Tuesday afternoon cruising the sample sales with my feminist friend Kim Gandy, the lady president of some lady thing, when the conversation turned, as it so often does, to sociopolitical analysis.
I think the country is ready for a woman president. Isn't it silly at this stage in our nation's history that people are even asking that question, not once, not twice, but 1,000 times? Of course a woman can be president. All around the world, women have been leaders of countries all over the world.
Do you like this color on me?
It's good. It's good. Women can do anything that men can do, and it's about time we had a chance to prove it. Well, that looks great.
Nice.
Kim was right. The gold top did look great on me. But what about that woman president thing she kept yammering about? I decided to get a second opinion. I met up with Washington Examiner columnist and TV pundit LaShawn Barber, my conservative La friend.
Women are the weaker sex. A leader should radiate confidence. Manly confidence.
Hello, Jimmy Carter. You could just smell his man musk right through the television.
Yeah, well, when he was elected, I hadn't hit puberty yet, so I wouldn't know anything about that.
Yeah, I hit puberty because of him.
Okay.
I practically got pregnant just by looking at him.
Women have a very nurturing quality, but I don't really want a nurturing leader.
By nurture, I assume you mean to take care of people.
Yes.
Yeah, I wouldn't want that either.
Samantha Bee from The Daily Show, Can a Woman Be President? Obviously the title of that skit. She's the author of I Know I Am, But What Are You? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we take another call. Jim. Okay. No, we had Jim already. Well, it's you.
It's
hi. Me. Hi, you. Hi.
Hello.
Go right ahead.
Hello.
Oh, hey.
Matthew. Hi, Matthew.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of actually the Colbert Report, but the first time I saw The Daily Show, I saw one of your clips, and it was just hilarious.
But
my question was relating to writer strike and what happened during that time, and what were you doing during the writer strike?
Nothing. Nothing. We were off the air for a long time. I'm trying to even think back now. It was a few years ago. We didn't really do much of anything. And then eventually we did have to go back on. I'm trying to recall exactly what happened, but we did have to go back on because people in our building who were not the people, there were many people working at the show who were going to lose their jobs, essentially, be laid off for an indeterminate period of time. So all the late-night shows kind of made that decision to go back on, and that's what we did. But we could not have... There were some caveats. We couldn't have written scripts. It was a completely different kind of show due to the writer's strike. And so we were very grateful when that was resolved.
Thanks, Matthew. Let's go to Peter next from Stoughton. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Hello.
I was wondering if Ms. B is going to be raising her children as Canadians or real Americans.
Whoa.
Oh, look at you with the controversial question. They are American. Both of my children, all of my children were born in the States. And so we are raising them as Americans. We're teaching them all the stuff that we don't know. I'm sure we're misleading them terribly about what it's like to be an American. But we, you know, we're very rah-rah, and we had our little July 4th celebration. So, yeah, they are full-blooded, full-throated American citizens, unlike us. They're going to have to sponsor us in the future.
Right. Which is it? Which
put a heavy, heavy burden on them.
Which relative was it? Was it, again, your grandmother who was just in love with American movie stars? And
she was. She really... My grandmother summered in the States a lot. She lived kind of close to the U.S. border for some time. And so she would spend her summers in Michigan. And she fell in love with Americans and just America and was very passionate about her love of American presidents and American history. And she was really so, it would be so pleasing for her
to know. She died before. She died in 1997, which was I came down to the States in 2003. So she never got to know the American side of me. But I can tell you that she is smiling down, you know, from heaven.
Oh, I'm sure.
Living down here. Although she would, I will say that she would much prefer that we live in California. It would be slightly distressing to her that we live in New York.
Right.
That was not her plan. But I don't think she would have ever kind of visualized me living down here and having American-born children. But it, I could not think of anything that would please her more greatly.
So she fell in love with America, and you fell in love with Jesus, who was your boyfriend.
Definitely. Wasn't he everyone's for a little while?
Not really, I don't think, Samantha, no.
Very gorgeous. Very,
very gorgeous.
Very fetching. Very fetching, the imagery. He definitely was my heartthrob.
And sounded, you thought, like, when you imagined him, Kenny Loggins.
Kenny Loggins, a little bit of Kris Kristofferson, you know, looked good in jeans, that kind of thing. But that's, you know, those are the images that we were faced with. I mean, there was that miniseries, Jesus of Nazareth, which was a heavy, heavy influence for me. I mean, I wept from start to finish every time I saw it.
You did, know, really?
Every Easter, they would haul it out. And he, you know, he had this luminous blue eyes. He was just magical.
Right. Karen, and that was that love lasted for a long time, as
I recall. It lasted for a long time. And then when it was done, it was truly done. It was just done.
Yeah.
I, something, you know, the influence of my mother, I suppose.
Your mother. And what were your mother's religious beliefs, Samantha?
She is Wiccan.
Right.
Actually, she is not at all. She was raised Catholic, and her Wiccanism was probably some kind of direct response to that, to being raised Catholic, and also, you know, out of her direct desire to offend my Catholic grandmother. she pursued that train of thought, but she's always been Wiccan. I am not Wiccan.
But no.
She did try and sort of make me Wiccan. She made me go to some ceremonies, and that was very terrifying for me.
Yeah, I can imagine. They're in the book. They're very, very funny.
Oh, thank you.
Karen from Mozini is our next caller. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Hi. I just want to say, first of all, that I love The Daily Show, and last semester, I'm a grad student in Stevens Point, and I took a 17th century literature class, and one of my papers, I chose to write about Jon Stewart.
You
and I
did?
Compared. Yeah, I compared his style of satire to Jonathan Swift.
Okay, okay.
The two of them are equally important voices in society.
Well,
and how
I think
their
he would
criticism...
be very flattered by that comparison.
I'm sorry?
I think that John would be very flattered by that comparison.
Oh, great. And I just think that it's very important how they take the ordinary actions of daily life and people and just point out the absurdity of human nature.
Well, thank you. We do our best. You know, sometimes it's all just very silly, but sometimes we do kind of get to the heart of something in a different way. We distill things in a different way. And I, for, you know, years prior to coming to the show, appreciated the show for that. And now I get to work there. It's kind of really exciting.
Here's an email from Tom. Samantha, I think you are one of the most clever talents working in any industry today. The whole staff. Hey, this is good.
Hey, this is a love fest. I love it.
You need it every now and then. The whole staff of The Daily Show is incredible. Truly, you all hold the same clout as the first Saturday Night Live group, the show of shows, or any of the great trendsetters in television. Loved you in The Book America and one of the best Daily Show sketches, NFLs. You are so good. I look forward to getting your book. I love Samantha Bee.
Oh, well, isn't that a nice way for me to now I can go out into the streets of hot New York City and feel like a champion.
Yes, you can.
I appreciate that.
Oh, yeah, you live in New York City. How is it? I mean, it's a mundane subject, except when it's 102, it's
well,
not mundane.
It's a little bit like walking into a bowl of chowder.
Ooh!
You know, hot clam chowder.
Ooh!
Horrible.
Yeah.
But it's livable. You know, I'll survive, I think.
Yeah. Another very funny, your book is just so funny, going on the honeymoon. a honeymoon with your parents' friends, Bob and Donna, with your girlfriend. Oh, my gosh.
Can you believe that my parents made me go on honeymoon?
No.
Can you believe that they had the audacity to accompany someone else on their honeymoon and were too cheap to get a hotel room? This was in our camping phase, and we took advantage of these. We were all kind of, you know, they had a pair of friends who got married, and they went out to the Maritimes. And we actually happened to be going out there around the same time. And so, and they were like, oh, we should, you know, we should get together when we're out there. And my father really took it as an invitation to accompany them on their honeymoon. And they didn't say anything about it. And so we just spent their entire honeymoon in their hotel room with them on rainy days watching TV in their room, using their shower. It must have been just a terrible... That couple is now divorced.
Oh, no.
They did not make it. It's my fault.
Oh, no.
And yet,
they're probably not friends anymore either.
I think that maybe Donna is still friends with my stepmom.
Really?
Yes. I believe that they are still, but the gentleman, the Bob, is not. But they dropped a bomb. They were so sick of, I think, having us in their hotel room that everyone was kind of getting tipsy, and then Bob started a conversation which ended with my father and stepmother trying to explain lesbianism to me.
Right.
In the most...
And you were how old at the time?
I think I was 8 or 9.
Yeah.
At the time.
Your sex education started when you were just a kid from your mom.
7 or... But I knew all of that.
You knew everything.
My mother had exposed me to all of that stuff. I mean, like, everything. Everything that's possible to do sexually, I already knew about in full graphic detail. So when my father and stepmother tried to explain lesbianism to me, it was, I mean, that was so vanilla to me. I just...
You knew
had
it.
No, but I couldn't tell them that I already knew what it was.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I didn't want to hurt their feelings or make them think that they weren't...
Hurt their
teaching
feelings.
...teaching me something valuable. So I just had to sit there and... kind of their terrible explanation of what it was.
So how are you going to teach sexuality education to your children, Samantha?
I have to say that it's a very interesting journey, which has already kind of started, because my daughter is 4, and she has a lot of questions. So I'm trying to approach it with, you know, from a point of view of honesty, but not giving too much information, giving exactly as much information as you are being asked for,
right,
is a kind of a delicate balance. But I think we're striking it right now. I think we're doing a pretty good job.
Yeah,
we're sort of feeling it out. And then when she seems satisfied, we just stop.
Right.
We don't go any further. We don't need to get any more graphic or anything like that. We just go as far as we think we need to go, and we just keep feeling it out with tiny baby steps. And she seems... She seems pretty good with it now, but we are having a baby, of course, so...
Right.
You know.
Right.
There's been some discussion along the way of where these things... How this happens.
Yeah, right.
You know, do you eat the baby and it sits in your stomach for a long time?
When is the baby due, Samantha?
August 10th, officially.
Uh-huh.
I am going with July 31st.
You are?
You know, the baby will be fully cooked by then.
Right.
I know that I will be fully cooked.
Right. Oh, to be pregnant in this kind of heat, too, it really must make you tired.
Well, it's not the best, but I will say that the third has been kind of the easiest pregnancy because it's been the least navel-gazing of all of them.
Right.
So, you know, you just really, there's nothing to be gained by complaining or anything of that nature. You still have to grocery shop,
right,
do all the things that you normally do, and take care of 2 kids.
Right.
And be pregnant. So what's the point?
Right.
When fatigued.
And your book has kind of that theme. There's no use complaining. This is my life. This, you know, it was, some of it was very, very strange, but why complain?
Well, why? It doesn't really, it's not going to benefit you. You just kind of make the best out of, you gotta just make it work. You gotta make it work, and you've gotta kind of do it with a smile on your face. Otherwise, what have you got? You just turn into a, you know, crazy person.
Yeah. Here's another compliment from another listener who talks.
Compliment.
Yeah. On The Daily Show, one really telling aspect of the brilliance of Jon Stewart in the show is the cast that he surrounds himself with and how he allows them to flourish and develop their talent. This is, well, I think that's true. The cast is fabulous.
Well, that's a lovely compliment, and thank you. As a part of that cast, I say thank you for that. But I will say he is actually incredibly supportive of people's ambitions outside the show, because he understands, as a performer himself, that, you know, that you have other interests and other opportunities that you want to pursue, and he's very, very supportive of those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I wanted to write a book, I went to him, and he was so sweet. I mean, he wasn't going to say no.
No,
but he just gave me a full blessing and full support, and it's really nice to know that you can. That because there could be a perception that there's a conflict, you know, you're not giving all of your time to something, but he's so great about it. It makes it, you know, it makes our relentless schedule so much easier to make.
Well, I'm glad you had time to write it because it's very funny. Well, Samantha, thank you. Good luck with the new baby and with the show.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Samantha B., the book is I Know I Am, But What Are You? And it is very funny. She is the most senior correspondent on The Daily Show. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing production work on this show, and to Chrissy Pease for on-air production. Thanks for your calls, everybody. We'll be with you again tomorrow at 9 o'clock.